doctor, of bad skin, of pestilence, of bad luck, if you like, of good luck, even. The building was his. Green cart stalks flashed in his mouth as he spoke. The old nun's god had been unable to save her, he said, looking up to the ceiling and pointing, as if he was still crouching there. Sister Mary Joseph Braze's eyes involuntarily followed his gaze before she caught herself. Meanwhile, his muddy eyes dropped from the ceiling to her face, to her lips, and to her bosom. If I know this much about my mother's voyage, it's because it came from her lips to the ears of others and then to mine. But her tale stopped in Aden. It came to an abrupt halt in that hothouse. What is clear is that she embarked on her journey with faith that God approved of her mission and would provide for her and protect her. But in Aden, something happened to her. No one knew what exactly. But it was there that she understood that her God was also a vengeful and harsh God, and could be so even to his faithful. The devil had shown himself in Sister Anjali's purple contorted death mask, but God had allowed that. She considered Aden an evil city, where God used Satan to show her how fragile and fragmented the world was, how delicate the balance between evil and good, and how naive she was in her faith. Her father used to say, "If you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans." She felt pity for saintly Amma, whose dream of enlightenment for Africa was vanity that cost Anjali's life. For the longest time, all I knew was this. After an unknown period of time that could have been months or even a year, my mother, aged 19, somehow escaped Yemen, then crossed the Gulf of Aden, then went overland perhaps to the walled and ancient city of Harar in Ethiopia, or perhaps to Djibouti. Then from there by train she entered Ethiopia via Dira Dawa, and then on to Addis Ababa. I know the story once she arrived at Missing Hospital. There were three spaced knocks on the door to Matron's office.
"Come in,"
Matron said, and with those two words, Missing was on a course different than anyone could have imagined. It was at the start of the short rains when Addis was stunned into wet submission, and when after hours and days of the sound and sight of water, one began hearing and seeing things. Matron wondered if that explained this vision of a beautiful, brown-skinned nun standing, but just barely, in the doorway. The young woman's recessed, unblinking brown eyes felt like warm hands on Matron's face. The pupils were dilated, as though, Matron would think later, the horror of the journey was still fresh. Her lower lip was ripe, as if it might burst at the touch. Her wimple, cinched at the chin, imprisoned her features in its oval. But no cloth could restrain the fervor in that face, or conceal the hurt and confusion. Her grey-brown habit must have once been white. But, as Matron's eyes traveled down the figure, she saw a fresh bloodstain where the legs came together. The apparition was painfully thin, swaying but resolute, and it seemed a miracle that it was capable of speech, when it said in a voice heavy with fatigue and sadness,
"I desire to begin the time of discernment, the time of listening to God as he speaks in and through the community. I ask for your prayers that I may spend the rest of my life in his Eucharistic presence and prepare my soul for the great day of union between bride and bridegroom."
Matron recognized the litany of apostolate entering the order, words she herself had uttered so many years ago. Matron replied automatically, just as her mother superior had done.
"Enter into the joy of the Lord."
It was only when the stranger slumped against the doorpost that Matron came out of her trance, running around her desk to grab her. Hunger? Exhaustion? Menstrual blood loss? What was this? Sister Mary Joseph Braze weighed nothing in Matron's arms. They took the stranger to a bed. Under the veil, the wimple and habit, They found a delicate wicker basket chest and a scooped-out belly.
A girl.
Not a woman.
Yes, a girl who'd only just bid goodbye to childhood.
A girl with hair that was not cut short like that of most nuns, but long and thick. A girl with, and how could they not notice, a precocious bosom. Every maternal instinct in Matron came alive, and she kept vigil. She was there when the young nun woke up in the night, terrified, delirious, clinging to Matron once she knew she was in a safe place.
Child, child, what happened to you? It is all right. You are safe now.
With such soothing words, Matron comforted her. But it was a week before the young nun slept alone, and another week before the color returned to her face. When the short rains ended, and when the sun turned its face to the city, as if to kiss and make up and say it was, after all, its favorite city for which it had reserved its most blessed cloud-free light, Matron led Sister Mary Joseph Praise outdoors. She was to introduce her to the missing people. The two of them entered Operating Theatre 3 for the first time, and an astonished matron watched as the stern and serious expression of her new surgeon, Thomas Stone, crumbled into something akin to happiness at the sight of Sister Mary Joseph Praise. He was blushing, taking her hand in his and crushing it till tears came to the young nun's eyes. My mother must have known then that she would stay in Addis Ababa forever, stay in Missing Hospital and in the presence of this surgeon. To work for him, for his patients, to be his skilled assistant was sufficient ambition, and it was an ambition without hubris, and, God willing, it was something she could reasonably do. A return journey to India through Aden was too difficult to contemplate. In the ensuing 7 years that she lived and worked at Missing Hospital, Sister Mary Joseph Praise rarely spoke about her voyage and never about her time in Aden.
"Whenever I brought up Aden," Matron said, "your mother would glance over her shoulder, as if Aden or whatever it was she left behind had caught up with her. The dread and terror on her face made me loath to ask again. But it scared me, I'll tell you. All she said was, 'It was God's will that I come here, Matron. His reasons are unknowable to us.' There was nothing disrespectful about that answer, mind you. She believed that her job was to make her life something beautiful for God. He had led her to Missing."
Such a crucial gap in the history, especially that of a short life, calls attention to itself. A biographer, or a son, must dig deep. Perhaps she knew that the side effect of such a quest was that I'd learn medicine, or that I would find Thomas Stone. Sister Mary Joseph Praise began the task of the rest of her days when she entered Operating Theatre 3. She scrubbed and gloved and gowned and stood across the table from Dr. Stone as his first assistant, pulling on the small retractor when he needed exposure, cutting the suture when he presented the ends to her, and anticipating his need for irrigation or suction. A few weeks later, when the scrub nurse couldn't be there, my mother filled in as scrub nurse and first assistant. Who knew better than a first assistant when Stone wanted a scalpel for sharp dissection, or when gauze wrapped around his finger would do? It was as if she had a bicameral mind, allowing one half to be scrub nurse, shuttling instruments from the tray to his fingers, while the other side served as Stone's third arm, lifting up the liver or holding aside the omentum, the fatty apron that protected the bowels, or with a fingertip pushing down edematous tissue just enough for Stone to see where his needle was to take a bite. Matron would peek in to watch.
"Pure ballet, my dear Marion. A heavenly pair, totally silent," Matron said. "No asking for instruments or saying wipe, cut or suction. She and Stone, you never saw anything quicker. I suspect that we slowed them down because we couldn't get people off and on the table quickly enough."
For 7 years, Stone and Sister Mary Joseph Praise kept the same schedule. When he operated late into the night and into the morning, she was across from him, more constant than his own shadow, dutiful, competent, uncomplaining, and never absent. Until, that is, the day when my brother and I announced our presence in her womb and our unstoppable desire to trade the nourishment of the placenta for the succor of her breasts. Chapter 2. The Missing Finger. Thomas Stone had a reputation at Missing for being outwardly quiet but intense and even mysterious, though Dr. Ghosh, the hospital's internal medicine specialist and jack-of-all-trades, disputed that last label, saying, "When a man is a mystery to himself, you can hardly call him mysterious." His associates had learned not to read too much into Stone's demeanor, which a stranger might think was surly when in fact he was painfully shy. Lost and clumsy outside it, inside Operating Theatre 3, he was focused and fluid, as if it was only in the theatre that body and soul came together, and where the activity within his head matched the terrain outside. As a surgeon, Stone was famous for his speed, his courage, his daring, his boldness, his inventiveness, the economy of his movements, and his calmness under duress. These were skills that he'd honed on a trusting and uncomplaining population, briefly in India and then in Ethiopia. But when Sister Mary Joseph Praise, his assistant for 7 years, went into labor, all these qualities vanished. On the day of our birth, Thomas Stone had been standing over a young boy whose belly he was about to open. He held his hand out, palm up, fingers extended, to receive the scalpel in that timeless gesture that would forever be the measure of his days as a surgeon. But for the first time in 7 years, steel had not slapped into his palm the instant his fingers opened. Indeed, the diffident tap told him someone other than Sister Mary Joseph Braise stood across from him. "Impossible," he said, when a contrite voice explained that Sister Mary Joseph Praise was indisposed. In the preceding 7 years, there hadn't been a time when he'd stood there without her. Her absence was as distracting and maddening as a bead of sweat about to fall into his eye when he was operating. Stone didn't look up as he made his keyhole incision. Skin, fat, fascia, split the muscle. Then, using blunt dissection, he exposed the glistening peritoneum, which he incised. His finger slithered into the abdominal cavity through this portal and rooted for the appendix. Still, with each step, he had to wait for a fraction of a second, or wave off the proffered instrument in favor of another. He worried about Sister Mary Joseph Praise, even if he was unaware that he was worrying, or unwilling to admit it. He summoned the probationer, a young, nervous Eritrean girl. He asked her to seek out Sister Mary Joseph Praise and remind her that doctors and nurses couldn't afford the luxury of being ill. "Ask her." The terrified probationer's lips were moving as she tried to by heart his message. "Kindly ask her if..." His eyes were free to look at the probationer, since his finger was now sounding the boy's insides better than any pair of eyes. "If she recalls that I returned to the operating theatre the very next day after performing a ray amputation on my own finger." That event took place 5 years before and was an important milestone in Stone's life. His own curved needle on a holder had nicked the pulp of his right index finger while he worked in a pus-filled belly. He immediately stripped off his glove, and with a hypodermic needle he had injected acroflavine, precisely 1 milliliter of a solution diluted 1 to 500, down the tiny track the errant needle had traveled. Then he'd infiltrated the fluid into the surrounding tissue as well. The orange dye transformed the digit into an oversized lollipop. But despite these measures, in just hours a creeping red wave extended down from the fingertip and into the tendon sheath in the palm. Despite oral sulfur triad tablets, and later, at Ghosh's insistence, injection of precious penicillin into his buttocks, scarlet streaks, which were the hallmark of streptococcal infection, showed at his wrist, and the epitrochlear lymph node behind the elbow became as big as a golf ball. The rigors had made his teeth chatter and the bed shake. This later became an aphorism in his famous textbook, a stonism, as readers called it. "If the teeth chatter, it is a chill, but if the bed shakes, it is a true rigor." He He had made a quick decision, to amputate his own finger before the infection spread farther, and to do the operation himself. The probationer waited for the rest of his message while Stone drew the worm-like appendix out of the incision and straightened up like a fisherman who'd reeled his quarry onto the deck. The few bleeders Stone snapped off with hemostats, like a marksman firing at pop-up ducks, while also clamping off the blood vessels to the appendix. He tied these off with catgut, his hands a blur, until all the dangling hemostats were removed. Stone held up his right hand for the probationer's inspection. 5 years after the amputation, the hand looked deceptively normal, though on closer study, the index finger was missing. The key to this aesthetically pleasing result was that the metacarpal head, the knuckle of the missing finger, had been cut away too, so that no stump was visible in the V between thumb and middle finger. It was as if the fingers had simply moved over one notch. Four-fingered custom gloves added to the illusion of normalcy. Far from being a disadvantage, his hand could negotiate crevices and tissue planes that others could not, and his middle finger had developed the dexterity of an index finger. That, together with the fact that his middle finger was longer than his former index finger, meant he could tease an appendix out from its hiding place behind a cecum, the beginning of the large bowel, better than any surgeon alive. He could secure a knot in the deepest recess of the liver bed with just his fingers, where other surgeons might resort to a needle holder. In later years, in Boston, he famously punctuated his admonishment to his interns of semper per rectum per annum salutem. If you don't put your finger in it, you'll put your foot in it. By holding up the former middle finger, now elevated to the status of index finger. Those who trained with Stone never overlooked the rectal exam on their patient, not just because Stone had drilled into their heads that most colon cancers are in the rectum or sigmoid, many within reach of the examining finger, but also because they knew they'd be fired for this omission. Years later in America, a story circulated about one of Stone's trainees, a man named Blessing, who, after examining a drunk in the emergency room and taking care of whatever the problem was, returned to his call room. As he was about to sleep, he remembered that he hadn't done a rectal exam. Guilt and fear that his chief would somehow discover his lapse moved him to get up and go out into the night. Blessing tracked the patient down to a bar, where for the price of a beer, the man agreed to drop his pants and be digitally examined. Be blessed, as the event came to be described, and only then was the young doctor's conscience eased. The probationer in Operating Theater 3 on the day of Sister Mary Joseph Braze's labor and our birth was a pretty, no, a beautiful, young Eritrean girl. Sadly, her humorless intensity, the dedication she showed to her training, made people forget her youth and her looks. The probationer hurried off to find my mother, not pausing to question the propriety of the message she carried to Sister Mary Joseph Braze. Stone, of course, would never have imagined the message might be hurtful. As is so often the case with shy yet talented people, Stone was generally forgiven what Dr. Koch called his social retardation. The glaring gaps that inner bowel repair could have been fatal were overlooked when they occurred in such a personality. They weren't an impediment to him, only an irritation to others. At the time of our birth, the probationer was not yet 18. With a tendency to confuse penmanship and keeping a neat medical record, and thereby pleasing matron, with the actual care of patients. Being senior most of the 5 probationers in Missing's nursing school had been a matter of pride for her, and most days she managed to push to the back of her mind the fact that her seniority was only because she was repeating her year, or, as Dr. Ghosh put it, because she was on the long-term plan. Orphaned as a child by smallpox, which had also left a faint lunar landscape on her cheeks, the probationer had from a young age addressed her self-consciousness by becoming excessively studious, a trait encouraged by the Italian nuns, the sisters of the Negrizia, Africa, who raised her in the orphanage in Asmara. The young probationer displayed her studiousness as if it were not merely a virtue, but a God-given gift, like a beauty spot or a supernumerary toe. What promise she'd shown in those early years, sailing through church school in Asmara, skipping grades, speaking fluent official Italian, as opposed to the bar and cinema version spoken by many Ethiopians, in which prepositions and pronouns were dispensed with altogether, and able to recite even her 19 times table. You could say the probationer's presence at Missing was an accident of history. Her hometown of Asmara was the capital city of Eritrea, a country which had been an Italian colony from as far back as 1885. The Italians under Mussolini invaded Ethiopia from Eritrea in 1935, with the world powers unwilling to intercede. When Mussolini threw his lot in with Hitler, his fate was sealed, and by 1941, Colonel Wingate's Gideon force had defeated the Italians and liberated Ethiopia. The Allies gave Emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia a most unusual gift. They tacked on the very old Italian colony of Eritrea as a protectorate of newly liberated Ethiopia. The emperor had lobbied hard for just this, so that his landlocked country could have the seaport of Massawa, not to mention the lovely city of Asmara. The British perhaps wanted to punish the Eritreans for their long collaboration with the Italians. Eritrean askaris, thousands of them, were part of the Italian army and had fought their black neighbors and died alongside their white masters. For the Eritreans to have their lands handed to Ethiopia was an unimaginable wound, akin to giving liberated France to England merely because the people of both countries were white and ate cabbage. When, a few years later, the emperor annexed the land, the Eritreans at once began a guerrilla war for their liberation. But there were some advantages to Eritrea being part of Ethiopia. The probationer won a scholarship to the country's only nursing school in Addis Ababa at Missing Hospital, the first young person from Eritrea to be so rewarded. The trajectory of her scholastic progress to that point was spectacular and unprecedented, a model for all youth. It was also an invitation to fate to stick a foot out and trip her. Yet it wasn't fate that stymied the probationer when she came to her clinical years. And it wasn't her clumsiness with the Amharic language or with English, since she soon overcame these obstacles and became fluent. She discovered that memorization, by-hearting, as Matron called it, was of no help to her at the bedside, where she struggled to distinguish the trivial from the life-threatening. Oh yes, she could and did recite the names of the cranial nerves as a mantra to calm her own nerves. She could rattle off the composition of Mistura Carminativa, 1 gram of soda bicarb, 2 milliliters each of spirit of ammonia and tincture cardamom, 0.6 milliliter of tincture of ginger, 1 milliliter of spirit of chloroform, topped off with peppermint water to 30 milliliters for dyspepsia. But what she couldn't do, and it annoyed her to see how effortlessly her fellow probationers could, was develop the one skill Matron said she lacked. Sound nursing sense. The only reference to this in her textbook was a statement so cryptic, more so after she memorized it, that she began to think it was put there to antagonize her. Sound nursing sense is more important than knowledge, though knowledge only enhances it. Sound nursing sense is a quality that cannot be defined, yet is invaluable when present and noticeable when absent. To paraphrase Osler, a nurse with book knowledge but without sound nursing sense is like a sailor at sea in a seaworthy vessel but without map, sextant, or compass. Of course, the nurse without book knowledge has not gone to sea at all. The probationer had at least gone to sea, she was sure of that. She was determined to prove that she did have map and compass, and so she would regard every assignment as a test of her skills. An opportunity to display sound nursing sense, or to hide the lack of it. She ran as if Jin were chasing her through the sheltered walkway between the theater and the rest of the hospital. Patients and relatives of those being operated on that day were squatting or sitting cross-legged on either side of her path. A barefoot man, his wife, and 2 small children shared a meal, dipping fingers into a bowl lined with injera on which a lentil curry had been poured, while an infant, all but hidden by the mother Sharma, suckled at the breast. The family turned in alarm as she ran by, and it made her feel important. Across the yard, she could see women in white shamas and bright red and orange headscarves crowding the outpatient benches, looking at that distance like hens in a chicken coop. In the nurse's quarter, she ran up the stairs to my mother's room. When she knocked, there was no answer, but the door was unlocked. In the darkened room, she saw Sister Mary Joseph Praise under the covers, her face turned toward the wall.
"Sister?"
she called softly, and when my mother moaned, the probationer took that to mean she was awake.
"Dr. Stone sent me to tell you."
She felt relieved to have remembered all the parts of the message. She waited for a response, and when my mother didn't volunteer one, the probationer imagined that my mother might be annoyed with her.
"I only came because Dr. Stone sent me. I'm sorry to disturb you. I hope you feel better. Do you need anything?"
She waited dutifully, and after a while, she eased out of the room. Since there was no return message for Dr. Stone, and since her pediatric nursing class was about to start, she did not return to Theatre 3. It was early afternoon by the time Stone went to the nurse's quarters. He had finished the appendectomy, then 2 gastrojejunostomies for peptic ulcer, 3 hernia repairs, 1 hydrocele, a subtotal thyroid resection, and a skin graft, but by his standards, it had been torturously slow. An ordeal. With knitted brow, he ascended the stairs. He understood that his swiftness as a surgeon depended to a large degree, more than he ever imagined, on the skills of Sister Mary Joseph Praise. Why did he have to think about these things? Where was she? That was the point. And when would she be back? There was no answer when he knocked. It was the corner room on the second floor. The compounder's wife came charging up to protest this trespass by a male. Though Matron and Sister Mary Joseph Praise were the only nuns at missing, the compounder's wife acted as if she had been denied her true calling. With a sash low over her brow and a crucifix as big as a revolver, she looked like a nun. She considered herself a quasi-warden of the nurse's hostel, the keeper of the missing virgins. She had a spider sense for a male footstep, an incursion into her territory. But now, seeing who it was, she backed away. Stone had never been inside Sister Mary Joseph Praise's room. When she typed or worked on the illustrations for his manuscripts, she came to his quarters or to his office adjoining the clinic. He turned the handle, calling out, "Sister? Sister?" He was met by a miasma at once familiar and alarming, but he couldn't place it. He groped for the switch and swore when it eluded him. He stumbled to the window, bumping into a chest of drawers. He swung the glass-paned portion of the window in and then pushed back the wooden shutters. Daylight flooded the narrow room. On top of the chest of drawers was a heavy mason jar that drew the sun's rays. The amber fluid within reached all the way to the chunky lid, which was sealed with wax. At first, he thought the jar might hold a relic, an icon. A carpet of goose flesh swept down his arms, as if recognition came to his body before it came to his brain. There, suspended in the fluid, the nail delicately pivoting on the glass bottom like a ballerina on tiptoe, was his finger. The skin below the nail was the texture of old parchment, while the underbelly displayed the purple discoloration of infection. He felt a longing, an emptiness, and an itch in his right palm which only that missing finger could relieve. "I didn't know," he said, turning to her bed, but what he saw made him forget what he was going to say. Sister Mary Joseph Praise lay in agony on her narrow cot. Her lips were blue. Her lusterless eyes were focused beyond his face. She was deathly pale. He reached for her pulse, which was rapid and feeble. An uninvited memory from the Kalangute voyage of 7 years before came flooding over him. He recalled the feverish and comatose Sister Anjali. A cold sensation spread from his belly to his chest. He was overcome by an emotion that, as a surgeon, he had rarely experienced. Fear. His legs could no longer support him. He fell to his knees by her bed.
"Mary?"
he said. He could do nothing but repeat her name, From his lips, Sister Mary Joseph Braze's name sounded like an interrogation, then an endearment, then a confession of love spun out of one word. Mary?
Mary? Mary?
She did not, could not answer. An old man's palsy overtook his hands as they reached for her face. He kissed her forehead. In that extraordinary and unstoppable act, he realized, not without a twinge of pride, that he loved her, and that he, Thomas Stone, was not only capable of love, but that he had loved her for 7 years. If he'd been blind to his love, perhaps it was because it had happened as soon as he met her on those slippery stairs. It had happened when she had nursed him, bathed him, tried to revive him on the Kalangute. It had happened when she'd held him in her arms and wrestled and dragged his dead weight to a hammock and then spoon-fed life back into him. It had happened as they crouched over Sister Anjali's body. But love reached its apogee when Sister Mary Joseph Braze came to work alongside him in Ethiopia. And then it had never wavered. Love so strong, without ebb and flow or crests and troughs, indeed lacking any sort of motion so that it had become invisible to him these 7 years, part of the order of things outside his head which he had taken for granted.
Did Mary love him?
Yes. Of this he felt certain. She had loved him, but following his cue, always following his cue, she'd said nothing. And what had he done all these years? Only taken her for granted. Mary, Mary, Mary. Even the sound of her name was a revelation to him, since he'd never called her anything but sister. He was sobbing, terrified of losing her. But that, too, he saw was his selfishness, his need for her manifesting itself again. Would he have the chance to make amends? How stupid could a man be? Sister Mary Joseph Braze barely registered his touch. Her cheek was hot against his. He lifted the sheet. A generous swelling of her belly met his eyes. It was an axiom of his that any swelling in a woman's abdomen was a pregnancy until proven otherwise. But his mind overrode that thought, refusing to consider it. This was a nun, after all. Instead, he came to a snap diagnosis of bowel obstruction, or free fluid in the peritoneal cavity, or hemorrhagic pancreatitis, some sort of abdominal catastrophe. Maneuvering through the doorframe, then trying not to bump her feet on the banister, his sobs changing to grunts of effort, he carried her out from her quarters and then down the path to the operating theater. She felt heavier to Stone than she had a right to be. There was a question the chief examiner had posed to him when he appeared for the Royal College of Surgeons viva voce after passing his written examinations in Edinburgh. What first aid treatment in shock is administered by ear? His answer, words of comfort, had won the day. But now, in place of reassuring and soothing words that would have been humane and therapeutic, Stone yelled for help at the top of his voice. His shouts, taken up by the keeper of the virgins, brought everyone, including Gibru, the watchman, who came running from the front gate, along with Cthulhu and two other unnamed dogs at her heels. The sight of the blubbering, helpless Stone shocked Matron just as much as the sight of Sister Mary Joseph Braze's terrible state. Lord, he's done it again, was Matron's first thought. It was a well-kept secret that Stone had on 3 or 4 occasions since his arrival at Missing gone on a drunken binge. For a man who rarely drank, who loved his work, who found sleep a distraction, who had to be reminded to go to bed, these episodes were mystifying. They came with the suddenness of influenza and the terror of possession. The first patient on the morning list would be on the table, ready to be put under, but there'd be no sign of Stone. When they went looking for him the first time, they found a babbling, disheveled white man pacing in his quarters. During these episodes, he did not sleep or eat, slipping out in the dead of night to replenish his supplies of rum. On the last occasion, this creature had climbed the tree outside its window and perched there for hours, muttering like a cross hen. A fall from that height would have cracked its skull. Matron, when she had seen those bloodshot mongoose eyes staring down at her, fled, leaving Sister Mary Joseph Braise and Gauche to keep vigil and to try to talk him down, get him to eat, to stop drinking. As abruptly as it started, in 2 days, no more than three, the spell would be over, and after a very long sleep, Stone would be back at work as if nothing had happened, never making any reference to how he'd inconvenienced the hospital, the memory of it erased. No one ever brought it up to him because the other Stone, the one who rarely drank, would have been hurt and insulted by such inquiry or accusation. The other Stone was as productive as three full-time surgeons, and so these episodes were a small price to pay. Matron came closer. Stone's eyes were not bloodshot, and he didn't reek of spirits. No, he was unhinged by Sister Mary Joseph Braise's condition, and rightly so. As Matron turned her attention from Stone to Sister Mary Joseph Braise, she nevertheless felt a ghost of satisfaction. At last the man had bared his soul, displayed his feelings for his assistant. Matron ignored Stone's ramblings about volvulus or ileus or pancreatitis or tuberculous peritonitis. "Let's go to the theatre," she said, and when they were there, she said, "Lay her on the operating table." He sat her down, and Matron saw a sight she had seen 7 years before, blood-soaked Sister Mary Joseph Braise's dress in the region of her pubis. Matron's mind raced back to Sister Mary Joseph Braise's first arrival from Arden, and how blood on her habit then had caused similar concern. Matron had never asked the 19-year-old point-blank what caused the bleeding. The irregularity of the stain on that occasion had invited the observer to read meaning in its shape. Matron's imagination had constructed so many scenarios to explain that mystery. In the ensuing years, memory had changed the event from mysterious to mystical. Which was why Matron now glanced at Sister Mary Joseph Braise's palms and breast as Stone laid her down, as if she half expected to see bleeding stigmata, as if that first mystery had grown into the second mystery. But no, the only blood was at the vulva. Lots of blood, with dark clots and bright red rivulets that ran down the thighs. Matron had no doubt as blood dripped to the floor. This time it was secular bleeding. Matron seated herself between Sister Mary Joseph Braise's legs, willfully ignoring the stomach swelling that loomed in front of her. The labia were engorged and blue, and when Matron slid her gloved finger in, she found the cervix fully dilated. Of blood there was much too much. She swabbed and dabbed and pulled down on the posterior vaginal wall for a better view. When a piteous sigh emerged from her patient's lungs, Matron almost dropped the speculum. Matron's chest was pounding, her hands shaking. She leaned forward, tilted her head again to peer in. There, like a rock at the bottom of a mud pit, a stone of the heart, was a baby's head.
"Lord, she's—"
Matron said when she could finally speak, gasping at the sacrilegious word that threatened to choke her and which her mouth could no longer contain.
"Pregnant!"
Every observer I later talked to remembers this moment in Theatre 3, when the air stood still, when the loud clock across from the table froze and a long, silent pause followed. "Impossible," said Stone, for the second time that day, and even though it was incorrect and hardly the thing to say, it allowed them all to breathe again. But Matron knew she was right. She would have to deliver this baby. Dr. K. Hemalata, Hema to all of them, was out of station. Matron had delivered hundreds of babies. She reminded herself of this now to try and keep herself from panic. But how was she to push away not just her qualms but her confusion?
one of her own, a bride of Christ, pregnant. It was unthinkable. Her mind refused to digest this. And yet the evidence, an infant's skull, was there, right before her eyes.
The same thought distracted the scrub nurse, the barefoot orderly, and Sister Asqual, who was the nurse anesthetist. It caused them to trip over one another and knock down an intravenous drip as they scurried around the table, readying the patient. Only the probationer, who was mortified that she had failed that morning to recognize this crisis when she visited Sister Mary Joseph Braise, didn't stop to wonder how Sister Mary Joseph Braise got pregnant. Matron's heart felt as if it might gallop right out of her chest.
Lord, what worse circumstance can you construct for a delivery? A pregnancy that's a mortal sin, a mother-to-be who is like my own daughter, massive bleeding, ghostly pallor?
And all this when Hema, Missing's only gynecologist, not only the best in the country, but the best matron had ever seen, was away. Bocelli up in the piazza was marginally competent in obstetrics, but unreliable after 2 in the afternoon. And his Eritrean mistress was deeply suspicious of him leaving on house calls. Jean Tran, the half-French, half-Vietnamese fellow in Casa Popolare, did a bit of everything and smiled a lot. But assuming they could be reached, it would still be a while before either man would come. No, Matron had to do this herself. She had to forget the implications of the pregnancy. She had to breathe, concentrate. She had to conduct a normal delivery. But that afternoon and evening, normal would elude them. Stone stood by, his mouth open, looking to Matron for direction, while Matron sat facing the vulva, waiting for the baby to descend. Stone alternately crossed his hands in front of him and then dropped them by his sides. He could see Sister Mary Joseph Braise's pallor increasing. And when Nurse Asqual, in a panicked voice, called out the blood pressure,
"Systolic of 80, palpable!"
Stone wobbled as if he might faint. Despite uterine contractions, which Matron could feel through the belly and see in Sister Mary Joseph Braise's contorted face, and despite the fact that the cervix was wide open, nothing happened. A baby's head, high up in the birth canal, with the cervix flattened like a gasket around it, always reminded Matron of the shaved scalp of a bishop. But this bishop was staying put. And meanwhile, such bleeding! A dark and messy pool had formed on the table, and tidal eddies of blood came out of the vagina. Blood was to delivery rooms and operating theaters what feces were to tripe factories, but even so, it seemed to Matron that this was a lot of blood coming out.
"Dr. Stone,"
Matron said, her lips quivering. A bewildered Stone wondered why she was calling on him.
"Dr. Stone,"
she said again. For Matron, sound nursing sense meant a nurse knowing her limits.
For God's sake, she needs a cesarean section.
But she didn't say those words, because with Stone, it could have the opposite effect. Instead, her voice low, her head drooping, Matron pushed down on her thighs to bring herself to her feet and to vacate her spot between Sister Mary Joseph Praise's legs.
"Dr. Stone, your patient,"
she said to the man who everyone believed to be my father, putting in his hands not only the life of a woman that he chose to love, but our two lives, mine and my brother's, which he chose to hate. Chapter 3. The Gate of Tears. When Sister Mary Joseph Braise felt the herald cramps of labor, Dr. Kalpana Hemlata, the woman I would come to call my mother, was 500 miles away and 10,000 feet in the air. Off the starboard wing of the plane, Hema had a beautiful view of Bab al-Mandab, the Gate of Tears, so named because of the innumerable ships that had wrecked in that narrow strait that separated Yemen and the rest of Arabia from Africa. At this latitude, Africa was just the Horn, Ethiopia, Djibouti, and Somalia. Hema traced the Gate of Tears as it widened from a hairline crack to become the Red Sea, spooling north to the horizon. As a schoolgirl studying geography in Madras, India, Hema had to mark where coal and wool were produced on a map of the British Isles. Africa figured in the curriculum as a playground for Portugal, Britain, and France, and a place for Livingstone to find the spectacular falls he named after Queen Victoria, and for Stanley to find Livingstone. In future years, as my brother, Shiva, and I made the journey with Hema, she would teach us the practical geography she had taught herself. She'd point down to the Red Sea and say, "Imagine that ribbon of water running up like a slit in a skirt, separating Saudi Arabia from Sudan, then farther up keeping Jordan away from Egypt. I think God meant to snap the Arabian Peninsula free of Africa." "And why not? What do the people on this side have in common with the people on the other side?" At the very top of the slit, a narrow isthmus, the Sinai, thwarted God's intention and kept Egypt and Israel connected. The man-made Suez Canal finished the cut and allowed the Red Sea to connect with the Mediterranean, saving ships the long journey around the Cape. Hema would always tell us that it was over the Gate of Tears that she had the awakening that would change her life.
"I heard a call when I was in that plane. When I think back, I know it was you."
That rattling, airborne tin can always seemed an improbable place for her epiphany. Hema sat on the wooden bench seats that ran lengthwise on both sides of the ribbed fuselage of the DC-3. She was unaware of how badly her services were needed just then at Missing, the hospital where she worked for the last 8 years. The drone of the twin engines was so loud and unrelenting that half an hour into the flight, she felt as if the sound inhabited her body. The hard bench and choppy ride were raising blisters on her behind. Whenever she closed her eyes, she felt as if she were being hauled across a rutted landscape in the back of a bullock cart. Her fellow travelers on this flight from Aden to Addis Ababa were Gujaratis, Malayalis, French, Armenians, Greeks, Yemenis, and a few others whose dress and speech did not as clearly reveal their origins. As for her, she wore a white cotton sari, a sleeveless off-white blouse, and a diamond in her left nostril. Her hair was parted in the middle and gathered with a clip at the back and loosely braided below. She sat sideways looking out. She saw a grey dot below, the shadow cast by the plane on the ocean. A giant fish, she imagined, was swimming just below the surface of the sea, keeping pace with her. The water looked cool and inviting, unlike the interior of the DC-3, which had grown less steamy but was still thick with the mingled scents of the human freight. The Arabs had the dry, musty smell of a grain cellar. The Asians contributed the ginger and garlic, and from the whites came the odor of a milk-soaked bib. Through the half-open curtain to the cockpit, she could see the pilot's profile. Whenever he turned to glance at his cargo, his bottle-green sunglasses seemed to swallow his face, only his nose poking through. The glasses had been perched up on his forehead when she boarded, and Hema had noted then that his eyes were red like a rodent's. The odor of juniper berry on his breath advertised his fondness for gin. She developed an aversion to him even before he opened his mouth to herd his passengers onto the plane, snapping at them, "Allez!" as if they were subhuman. She bit her tongue then, because this was the man about to take them aloft. His face and jug ears resembled a figure a child might draw with crayon on butcher paper. But the details were beyond a child. The fine arbor of blood vessels on his cheeks, mutton-chop sideburns dyed boot polish black, the white ring of Arcus senilis around his pupils, gray eyebrows that betrayed his pretense at youthfulness. She wondered how a man could look in the mirror and not see the absurdity of his own appearance. She studied her own reflection in the porthole. Hers was a round face, too, the eyes widely spaced with a doll's pert nose. The red potu in the center of her forehead stood out. Her cheeks had a Martian tint cast on them by the cobalt-blue water below, and the hint of green in her eyes, unusual for an Indian, was accentuated.
Your gaze encompasses all men, makes your most ordinary glance seem intimate, carnal, Dr. Ghosh had told her, as though you are ravishing me with your eyes. Ghosh was a tease and forgot what he said as soon as the words rolled off his tongue. But this statement of his lingered with her. She thought of Ghosh's fur-covered limbs and shuddered. Body hair was one of her pet dislikes, or so she believed. She knew it was a fatal prejudice for an Indian woman. His was like a gorilla coat, the chest tendrils poking out through his vest and peeking up above his shirt collar.
"Ravishing! You wish, you lecher!"
she said now, smiling, as if Ghosh were sitting across from her. She had to give him this much. If she stared fractionally too long at a man, she attracted more attention than she intended. It was partly why she used spectacles with large wire frames, because she thought they made her eyes seem closer together. She liked the exaggerated Cupid's bow of her upper lip, but not her cheeks, which she felt were too chubby. What to do? She was a big woman. Not fat, but big. Well, maybe a bit fat, and she'd certainly put on a kilo, or two, or three in India. But how could she help that in the face of her mother's astonishing cooking? Because of my height, I get away with it, she told herself. Wearing a sari helps, of course. She grunted, remembering how Dr. Ghosh had invented a special term for her. Magnified. Years later, when Hindi movies with their song and dance became all the rage in Africa, the ward boys in Addis Ababa would call her Mother India, not in mockery, but in reverence for the tearjerker of the same name starring Nagras. Mother India had run for 3 straight months at the Empire Theatre and then moved to the cinema Adwa. That too without the benefit of subtitles. The ward boys could be heard singing Dunya Mein Hum Aaya Hai, We've Arrived in This World, though they didn't understand a word of Hindustani.
And if I'm magnified, what term shall I apply to you?
She said, carrying on the imaginary conversation, surveying her old friend from head to foot. He was not a conventionally good-looking man.
How about alien? I mean it as a compliment. I say alien, Ghosh, because you are so unaware of yourself, of your looks. There's a seduction in that for others. Alien becomes beauty. I'm saying this to you because you're not here. To be around someone whose self-confidence is more than what our first glance led us to expect is seductive.
Mysteriously, during her holidays, Ghosh's name kept popping up in her conversations with her mother. Despite Hema's lack of interest in marriage, her mother was terrified that her daughter would end up with a non-Brahmin, someone like Ghosh. And yet, as Hema neared 30, her mother had begun to feel that any husband was better than no husband at all.
You say he's not handsome? Does he have good color?
Ma, he's fair, fairer than me, and he has brown eyes, Bengali, Parsi, and God knows what other influences in those eyes.
What is he?
He calls himself high-caste Madras mongrel, she said, giggling.
Her mother's frown threatened to swallow her nose, and so Hema had changed the subject. Besides, it was impossible to construct a Ghosh for someone who'd never met him. She could say that his hair was combed flat and parted in the middle, looking sleek and smart for about 10 minutes in the morning, but after that, the hairs broke loose like rioting children. She could say how at any time of the day, even after he had just shaved, black stubble showed under his jaw. She could say that his neck was non-existent, squashed down by a head shaped like a jackfruit. She could say he just looked short because of a slight belly whose size was exaggerated in the way he leaned back and swayed from side to side as he walked, which drew the eye away from the vertical. Then there was his voice, unmodulated and startling, as if the volume knob had frozen on its highest setting. How could she convey to her mother that the sum total of all this made him not ugly, but strangely beautiful? Despite the rash on the backs of his hands, a burn really, his fingers were sensual. The ancient X-ray machine, Akeli Kut, had caused the rash. Just thinking of the coot made Hema's blood boil. In 1909, Emperor Menelik had imported an electric chair, having heard the invention would efficiently get rid of his enemies. When he discovered it needed electricity, he simply used it as a throne. Similarly, the big Kelly coot had come in the 1930s with an eager American mission group that soon realized that, even though electricity had arrived in Addis Ababa, it was intermittent and the voltage insufficient for such a temperamental beast. When the mission folded, the precious unpacked machine had been simply left behind. Missing lacked an X-ray machine, and so Ghosh reassembled the unit and matched it to a transformer. No one but Ghosh dared touch the coot. Cables ran from its giant rectifier to the Coolidge tube, which sat on a rail and could be moved this way and that. He worked the dials and voltage levers until a spark leaped across the two brass conductors, producing a thunderclap. The fiery display had caused one paralyzed patient to leap off the stretcher and run for his life. Ghosh called that the Sturm und Drang cure. He was the coot's keeper, repairing it, babying it, so that 3 decades after the company went under, the coot was still operational. Using the fluoroscopy screen, he studied the dancing heart, or else he defined exactly where a cavity in the lung resided. By pushing on the belly, he could establish whether a tumor was fixed to the bowel or abutted on the spleen. In the early years, he hadn't bothered with the lead-lined gloves or a lead apron for that matter. The skin of his probing, intelligent hands paid a visible price. Hema tried to imagine Ghosh telling his family about her.
She's 29. Yes, we were classmates at Madras Medical School, but she's a few years younger. I don't know why she never married. I didn't get to know her well till we were interns in the septic ward. She's an obstetrician. A Brahmin. Yes, from Madras. An expatriate, living and working in Ethiopia these 8 years.
Those were the labels that defined Hema, and yet they revealed little, explained nothing. The past recedes from a traveler, she thought. Sitting in the plane, Hema closed her eyes and pictured her schoolgirl self with the twin ponytails, the long white skirt, the white blouse under the purple half-sari. All Mrs. Hood secondary school girls in Mylapore had to wear that half-sari. Really nothing more than a rectangle of cloth to coil around the skirt once and pin on the shoulder. She'd hated it, because one was neither child nor adult, but half-woman. Her teachers wore full saris, while the venerable headmistress, Mrs. Hood, wore a skirt. Hema's protests triggered a lecture by her father.
"Do you not know how fortunate you are to be in a school with a British headmistress? Do you not know how many hundreds have tried to get in there, offer 10 times the money, but were turned down by Mrs. Wood? She goes by merit only. Would you prefer the Madras Corporation School?"
And so, each day, she put on the hated uniform, feeling half-dressed and feeling as if she were selling a piece of her soul. Vilu, the neighbor's son, who'd once been her best friend, but who had turned insufferable at 10, liked to perch on the dividing wall and tease her.
"The girls who come from Mrs. Wood, palivu. The girls who come from Mrs. Wood, palivu. The girls who come from Mrs. Wood haven't grown their womanhood, inky pinky palivu."
She ignored him. Vilu, who was as dark-skinned as she was light, said,
"So proud you are of being fair. Monkeys will nibble your sweet flesh thinking it is jackfruit on a jackfruit tree, mind you me."
There she was, 11 years old, setting off for school, dwarfed by her Raleigh bicycle, trading barbs with Vilu. Her books were in a tasseled sanji slung over her shoulder, the strap running between her breasts. Already in her posture and in her steady pedal strokes, there were signs of a certain immutability. The bicycle, once so tall and perilous, soon shrunk beneath her. Her breasts thrust out on either side of that sanji strap, and hair sprouted between her legs. If that was what Vilu had meant about not growing her womanhood, she had proved him wrong. She was a good student, a captain in netball, a senior prefect, and showing promise in Bharatanatyam, finding in herself a talent for recapitulating a most intricate dance sequence after being shown it just once. She felt neither an obligation to join the herd nor any urge to try to stand out from it.